For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week, Val Wood discusses her new historical romance, Children of Fortune, and reveals how it was shaped by lockdown. Robert Kirkwood explores a true historical crime with Tartan Noir author Denise Mina. I meet one of the RNIB Talking Book Studio's most prolific narrators. And Robert gets a lesson in how to love animals from author Henry Mance. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Award-winning romantic novelist Val Wood is an old friend of the show. Her work is often compared to that of Catherine Cookson, although Val has chosen her own locale of East Yorkshire as the backdrop for her novels. Like Catherine Cookson, Val is also an active supporter of sight loss charities and literacy. Her latest novel, her 27th, is out this month, and she joined me from her home near Hull to tell me all about it and what she's been up to since we last met. Val, welcome back to Read On.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to talk to you, Red.
So the new novel is set in 1864 and it deals with themes of family duty, honour and freedom.
Yes, I would say that's about it in a nutshell, really. Because of COVID last year, I found it quite difficult to start on a new novel. Somehow my imagination, which is always very fertile, was sort of stopped in a way. And I think it was the anxiousness of COVID hanging around us all. And I tried a couple of times with different characters and different themes. And each time I got to about, 3,000 or 4,000 words, I abandoned them. And I thought, no, it's not working. And then I went sort of to the old adage of write about what you know. And as I had finished The Lonely Wife, and I was very pleased with that, and I decided that I would continue with Beatrix's Children and what happened next. Now, the thing is, when you do a follow-on book, you have to be quite sure that anyone who hasn't read the first book understands what it's all about. It has to also be a standalone book. And so I decided I would use those young people, some children really, and watch them grow. And that is what I did. They had had a very happy childhood with their mother, but their father had been difficult, shall we say. But not only that, I wanted to write about the children and what would happen to them as they grew into adulthood. I thought I also needed something else, something more in the story. And so from the story that I had abandoned, I pulled out two or three other characters and decided that I would bring them into the new story. And so hence it was Children of Fortune. They weren't poor, any of them, but they had all had some issues. And so that's how I began that story.
And the story picks up in 1864. Beatrix is pregnant. Her daughter, Alicia, is 10 and very excited. And Beatrix has escaped her former unhappy circumstances. But as the book unfolds, we discover that the past is not going to leave either her or her three children alone.
That's right. And I think anything traumatic which has happened, particularly in your childhood, is bound to have an effect on anyone into their adulthood. And they have to individually make choices about what they want and what they want to do. Now, Alicia, she's always been a very steady sort of girl, knowing always what she wanted from life, even when she was very young. And so she is almost the foremost in the character of the children. Really, Laurie, who is the heir to the estate, he has had a different experience because he remembers his father more than Alicia or Ambrose do. And he had been imbued by his father's words to him that he was going to be heir to the estate and he must behave in such and such a manner. He was a kind boy, and he was rather anxious about life coming up. Now, Ambrose, who is the youngest one of the three children, he knew what he wanted to be right from the beginning, because a friend of the family had shown him some baby pigs when he was very small himself, and he had decided he wanted to be a pig breeder. So he was quite happy, was very steady, and as he didn't remember his father, his birth father anyway, it wasn't causing him any trouble. So this is how I think things happen in real life. And really, this is how I base my stories, because my characters, they become real to me. I'm almost giving them flesh and blood. If they don't appear real to me, then they're not going to appear to be real to my readers.
Yes, they're very recognisable as a family that we could meet in 2021. And yet they're surrounded by this rich Victorian social history. Yet again, you've really gone deep into the clothing and the farming practices and the manners of the 1860s.
Well, that is always my aim, I must say. And they were the same, as you say, same people, exactly. Except, of course, they conformed, really, to the mores, shall we say, of that time. Women in particular, that theme always runs through my books as to what women could and could not do. Beatrix, by going to live in Yorkshire, found that she actually could do really as much as she wanted to do. It was just when they went into town, when they had to remember that women were not supposed to walk alone. When they went on a train, they were not supposed to go alone. They had to always have a companion with them. So there was a difference, and my goodness, wouldn't women hate that today? But the clothing, it is important, particularly if, say, they're going to a wedding, something like that. And I have a wonderful book on my shelves. And so I can choose. I love doing that. I love choosing the way they're going to dress. And of course, a lot of women then, they did their own sewing, or they had a sewing maid who would make things for them. And I think country people have probably not changed hugely, apart from modern technology, and they all have mobile phones and so on. And that's another thing. When one person, one character is going to meet another, I have to remember that they can't text or email and say, see you in half an hour. That just would not happen. And it's about space and time as well. If they're going somewhere that, you know, they could get a train at that period. And I think there were probably much better trains then than they are now. Not as fast, of course, but probably more reliable. But it's that kind of thing. I have to immerse myself into the 19th century in order to get that sort of thing right. I never use modern expressions. Sometimes if I'm reading a book and they use a modern expression in an historical novel, it really, really annoys me. So it's things like that. I've got a whole list of them in a book of what not to put in my book.
The lack of technology also opens up a world of surprises. There's a wonderful moment at the beginning of the book where Beatrix gives birth to twins. She had no idea that she was carrying twins, which, of course, in 2021 in Yorkshire would be pretty inconceivable.
Well, the thing is as well, she has a conversation. Would it be a boy or a girl? And of course, I had no idea, because nobody did have an idea. I think they used to swing something across a woman's pregnant belly. Was it a coin on a string to see whether it was a boy or a girl? And if it swung one way, it was a boy. If it swung another way, it was a girl. I'm sure I remember that from my own childhood, really. Although I'm not as old as all that.
I know that you moved to East Yorkshire when you were about 13.
Yes.
Following your father, who was an assessor for damage caused by Hitler's bombing in the Second World War.
That's right.
And I wonder if part of the reason you are fascinated by the past is to reconstruct the Yorkshire that was obliterated by the Second World War.
Yes, I think you're right, actually, because where I was born, actually, in Castleford in West Yorkshire, and we lived with my granny. And granny's house, which was probably very late Victorian, a terraced house, probably a miner's house, because we lived very close to the coalface, really. And she didn't have any electricity. She only had gas in her house. So talking about kitchens and so on, that's actually almost in my childhood, because granny had a very small gas ring. We had candles for taking us up to bed, very narrow staircases, such as I write about. And I can remember going upstairs holding a candle in the candlestick holder. Can you imagine that happening today? I wouldn't let my small children have done that at all. But that's the way it was. Granny also had, in her scullery, she had what we called a set pot. Now, people in East Yorkshire don't know what that is, but that's what we called it in the West Riding. And what it is a brick-built boiler with a place underneath for the fire, and it's where she heated her water for washing day. And she also cooked hams in there, not at the same time, obviously. And that was a source of hot water. But otherwise, we only had cold water taps. Getting washed in the morning for school, it was cold water or having to boil a kettle. So things like that, I do remember, they're imprinted in my head. And so in those aspects, I can remember those, and it helps me. And also, I have some old photographs hanging on my kitchen wall, and they're of my granny when she was a young girl, and she was wearing this dark skirt and a blouse with leg of mutton sleeves, as they were called, very full. And then I have another, even older one, of her in-laws and my great-grandfather, who was an innkeeper, and his wife there with him. And she's got a very sour face, I have to say, but she must have been terrified of the man before her, underneath a big black cloth, taking a photograph. It looks like a wedding photograph to me, because she's wearing a really pretty dress and bonnet. And I think that wouldn't have been her normal wear as an innkeeper's wife. So there's all sorts of things that I can pick up. And, well, I do have a very fertile imagination, and I can transform myself back into the 19th century without too much of a problem, really.
In your novels, which are always populated by a wonderful cast of characters, one of the major characters is always the landscape of the East Riding of Yorkshire.
Yes, it is, and also the estuary, because the estuary, for me, in my novels, becomes almost a character of its own. I've often used it in really adverse conditions, and I've had drownings there, but it just keeps rolling along, really, like old Father Thames. And it has moods, does the estuary. You know, the water's coming in from the North Sea, and North Sea can be quite bad-tempered, I think, at times. And the landscape, of course, I just love the rolling hills. People call it flat who don't know it, but it's actually undulating. And you can see for miles, and you can get the most wonderful guys there, morning or night. I think where they are living, where my characters are living, it just has to be right. And when I'm starting a new novel, my younger daughter, I'll say to her, right, I need to go and find a place now for my characters to live. Once I've got the characters in my mind, and I know who they are, I've got to place them. And so off we go on Saturday afternoon or something, and I go touring around and looking where I can build my house for these people, which is what I did in North Therabee. And we were going up a slight hill, there was a green space on one side, and I said, stop, this is it, thank you. All right, we can go home now. And I had it in my head as to where I was going to build my house, almost within sight of the estuary, where Beatrix at least felt that she could hear it.
The text of the book has been made accessible to those of us who can't read print, again, by the wonderful Anne Dover, who
oh,
is...
Oh, yes.
She's very much your narrator of choice, isn't she?
She really is. I always ask for her. And I don't know whether or not you would know this, but she sent me an email to say that the Romantic Novelists Association, and they have prize giving every year for the best novel, historical novel, romance and things like that. And this year they had a prize for narrator of the year. And there were just four, and Anne was one of them. And she was so thrilled about it all.
Can you saddle up on your own?
Yes, but that's not fun, Alicia pouted. I'll just be trotting round and round in circles. And besides, the hens get in the way and they're always squawking. I want to go up the road to see Granny Mags.
Well, you can't, Dora said firmly. Not on your own, and not today, she repeated. Your mamma likes to know where you are, otherwise she gets worried about you. And we can't have that, can we?
Alicia shook her head.
Could I have some lemonade, then? Please, she added.
Yes, Dora conceded. Go outside again and sit at the table, and I'll ask Ambrose if he'd like some too, and he can join you.
Anne Dover, narrating Children of Fortune, written by my guest, Val Wood. And Val, I know your commitment to making print accessible stretches back way further than your audiobooks. Reading the Talking Magazine for the Blind in East Yorkshire for over 27 years now, I believe.
Well, I don't do it anymore, Red, simply because circumstances at home. But I was reading and editing. It was the Hull and District Talking Magazine for the Blind. And the editors chose pieces from various newspapers and magazines and so on and put them all together for the reader. And we had several teams of readers. I left after 28 years. My colleague who worked alongside me, she had done 30 years. But what happened was that rather than do one recording a month, they were going to try and do them weekly. And I knew that because my husband was ill at the time, I knew I couldn't do any more than I was doing. So decided to call it a day, really. But still keep in touch. And I actually do receive the recordings that are sent out now, so I can listen and find out what is happening, because I don't tend to get a newspaper, and I can listen online to the Talking Magazine. And there are still quite a few of the readers there who were there when I was too, so they've been going for a long, long time. It's an absolutely fantastic organisation. And through them, I'm very firmly committed to site support in Hull, where I am the vice president. I'm the vice president of site support in Hull too. And it's just so important, I feel, to belong with charities such as that.
Well, Val Wood, many congratulations on the publication of your 27th novel, Children of Fortune. And thank you for being a guest on Read On today.
Thank you so much, Red. It's been lovely meeting you again, all your listeners too. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Children of Fortune joins a wide selection of Val Wood's other novels in the RNIB library. And Val will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
If you need someone who understands sight loss, we're here for you. Our free and informal Living Well with Sight Loss courses aim to help you increase your independence, boost your confidence, and connect with others to share experiences. Join a course by visiting rnib.org.uk/livingwellwithsightloss or call us on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, we'll hear from one of the RNIB's most prolific narrators, and Robert Kirkwood gets a lesson in how to love animals. But first, back in October, Robert went to the annual Wigtown Book Festival. Although many of the events were virtual, he did get the opportunity to meet some of the authors in attendance, including master crime writer Denise Mina.
Denise Mina's first novel, Scarlet Hill was published in 1998, and it won the Crime Writers Association Award for Best First Crime Novel. Garnet Hill became a trilogy. Then came the Paddy Meehan novels, the Alex Morrow novels, and much more, including plays and graphic novels. In 2017, she made her first foray into true crime in the book The Long Drop, based on the 1958 trial and execution of the serial killer Peter Manuel. She was at the Wigtown Book Festival talking about her second true crime novel, and this one goes back a few years, to 1566. Ritzel by Denise Mina is a radical take on one of the darkest episodes in Scottish history. It's a short tale of sex, seduction, secrets and lies, one that looks at history through a modern lens and explores the lengths that men and women will go to in search for love and power. Mary, Queen of Scots, is 6 months pregnant. She doesn't know that her palace is surrounded, that right now an army of men is creeping upstairs to her chamber. They are coming to murder David Rizzio, her friend and secretary, the handsome Italian man who is smiling across the table at her. Mary's husband wants it done in front of her, and he wants her to watch it done. The audio version is read by Katie Lung, and we'll hear from that in a moment. But at the Wigtown Book Festival, Denise read from the book herself.
David Rizzio plays tennis with his assassins. Late Saturday afternoon, 9th of March, 1566. Indoor tennis court, Palace of Holyrood, Edinburgh. Lord Ruthven wanted him killed during this tennis match, but Darnley said no. Lord Darnley wants it done tonight. He wants his wife to witness the murder, because David Rizzio is her closest friend, her personal secretary, and she's very pregnant. So Darnley hopes that if she sees him being horribly brutalised, she might miscarry and die. She's the queen. They've been battling over Darnley's demand for equal status since their wedding night, and if she dies and the baby dies, then Darnley's own claim to the throne will be undeniable. They're rivals for the crown. She knew that from the off. So he wants it done in front of her. Darnley serves to Rizzio, and Rizzio returns it with an elegant stroke. The cork ball soars across the court, reaches the far quarter and bounces high enough to land on the sloped wooden awning over the watchers' benches. There's a loud smack as it lands, rolls to the edge and falls onto the court. Plop, plop, plop. Point to Rizzio. Underneath that sloping roof is a man called Henry Yeare. He's watching the game, sitting on a bench built into the wall of the inner court. He's Lord Ruthven's retainer, and he's here to keep an eye on Darnley for the boss. Henry Yeare hates everyone here, and he especially hates tennis. Tennis is what's wrong with people. Yeare is very pale, his eyes rimmed red because he hasn't been sleeping. He's watchful. He sees plots everywhere, and he thinks in absolute binaries. Good, bad, man, woman, Calvinist, Catholic, for God or against God. Once fervently Catholic, he's now ferociously Calvinist. When he saw the truth, he embraced it, and he hates those who don't, those Catholic holdouts. How can they hold on to these old, broken ideas? How can they defend a church so corrupt, so murderous, such a betrayal of the one true faith? They disgust him. He doesn't know how they can live with themselves. Other Calvinists congratulate him on his passion. They overlook the implied violence of his fanaticism because he's on their side. The Reformation is recent. The issue is undecided. It's not yet safe. Everyone is afraid of a revival of the Roman religion, of being killed for their beliefs. They're afraid of spies and foreign interventions. Men as hot and spirited as Yeare are useful to the Protestant movement. And tomorrow morning, when fellow Calvinists hear that Yeare was creeping around Edinburgh, when they learn what he did, who he killed, they'll all feign surprise. But in the darkness of their hearts, they'll each remember his sallow face and wide, watery eyes, his explosive reaction to any hint of dissent. And they'll admit to themselves that this was inevitable, that they rewarded his disquieting fervour, and they've long known this could happen. Could have been any one of them stabbed in their beds by Yeare. Yeare was always a killing spree looking for an excuse. It's a very short book about the murder of David Rizzio at Holyrood Palace in 1566. I was asked to write it by James Crawford, who is producing a series of these short novelisations. It's called Darklands, and that's the series of contemporary writers taking on moments in Scottish history.
Now, it's narrated by Katie Long. After hearing you read them there, why haven't you done any of your books?
Katie Long's great, and I think I can't be bothered. I don't, you know, I think I've got, there are so many really talented voice actors, do you know what I mean? Mm. And I think it always adds something when someone else does it. Sometimes you do hear things that you wouldn't have, there was a panic when she wasn't sure how to say the word Rizzio, when I had to send her a recording of Ruthven.
Year eyes David Rizzio at the far end of the court. He's small and ugly and foreign. His skin looks dirty. He's crafty and sly. He's only a singer, so what's he doing giving the Queen advice? The rumour is that he's a papal spy. Year maps every room with his sectarian dividers. He knows who is with us, who again. To justify the intensity of his disgust, he suspects every Catholic of every crime he can think of. Year was a priest, a confessor. And he, of all people, should know how obdurate Catholics think. Sodomy, theft, lust, pederasty, child murder. Treason both high and petty. High treason is an attack on the state. Petty treason is an attack by a subordinate on a superior, usually a husband murdered by a wife. It's worse than simple murder because of the element of betrayal. It upsets the natural order of things, how God wants the world to be ordered. And in denying her husband what he wants, the Queen has become a petty treasonist.
Do you think listening to the book changes the reading experience?
Yes, it does. Because I listen to a lot of books and often I think this is a scene book and I buy the book and then I go back and read it on the page. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Sometimes the writer doesn't say the name of the person often enough, or do you know what I mean? I get a bit lost sometimes. Mm. But some books are even better if they're just read to you, I think.
It's your second true crime novel after The Long Drop. Why did you move to true crime?
Well, I always loved true crime, and a lot of my crime novels are based on true crimes. And sometimes it felt a bit dishonest to pretend that I was making it all up, because a lot of us, you know, Edgar Allan Poe's second ever detective novel, which is the Birth of Crime Fiction, was based on a true crime story. And a lot of us take from true crime, but we always pretend it's completely different. It isn't.
Darnley serves to Rizzio at the hazard end. Rizzio returns the ball to Darnley, and back it goes to Rizzio, who knocks it out. Rizzio wins the set and smirks, trying to press the delight from his lips. Darnley scowls, turns away to the wall, and lifts a sweat rag to wipe his face, and Year sees him up close. Darnley's 21, and handsome, and arrogant. His lips are a furious tight little O. He holds the cloth over his face for a long time. Year loves the severity of Calvinism, the purity of it. He uses it as a hook for his prickly disapproval of everything. Dancing, laughing, foolishness, blasphemy, singing, food, lechery, wine, jokes, even colours. And especially tennis.
There are many of Denise Mina books in the RNIB library. And Rizzio by Denise Mina is available commercially now.
Thanks, Robert. And we'll be returning to Wigtown later in the show. This is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, as we've just heard, the value of a good narrator cannot be underestimated in bringing a story to life as an audiobook. And my next guest is one of the best in the business. If you're a fan of the big American thriller writers, or just a regular user of the RNIB Talking Books Library, you'll be familiar with Jeff Harding's voice. He joined me down the line to chat over some of the highlights in his long and varied career. Jeff Harding, it's a privilege to welcome you to Read On.
Great to be here, thanks.
I was looking through the RNIB Talking Books Library and your name is attached to no fewer than 239 titles. And you're still recording them, aren't you?
I am. I was very grateful to be taken in by the RNIB and then introduced to other companies.
How did you come to RNIB in the first place?
Well, it started out with an actress I knew called Helen Horton, and she recommended me to Talking Books, and then I heard about RNIB at Talking Books, so I started reading for them. That was back in the days of Great Portland Street.
That's going back a bit. Do you remember what your first book was for RNIB?
I really don't. I think one of the early ones was something to do with spirituality in California, and we were all going to become beams of light in the Oregon Redwood Forest.
Many, many of the titles that you've narrated over the years are for the big thriller writers, the Tom Clancy's, Dan Brown's, and of course Lee Child as well. What is it about your voice, do you think, that makes you the go-to man for so many of the big thriller writers?
Well, you know, our voices are God's gift, and mine seems to suit that kind of material, so I do get a lot of it.
Do you have a favourite amongst them, or is that an unfair question to ask you?
It's a perfectly fair question. You mean amongst the Jack Reachers, it would have to be one shot.
And amongst the thriller writers?
I'd have to say it'd be either Lee Child. I really enjoyed the Philip Kerr series with Bernie Gunter. And I do a lot of Clive Cussler, which is a giggle.
I was going to say, I mean, there's virtually an entire page of Clive Cussler titles in the RNIB library. And I thought I'd read a few of them over the years, but clearly not as many as you have.
Well, he's got help in them now. I don't know how old he must be, but they still go on. I do two or three a year.
And coming back to Lee Child, I mean, One Shot is one of my favourite of his titles as well. What is it about Jack Reacher? I mean, you clearly get right into his character when you're narrating them.
Yeah, it's like writing it for me. I fall into the rhythms naturally. It gives me pleasure to recite Mr. Child's books. But, your question?
Do you prepare by reading the book through once or twice beforehand, marking it all up, or are you so used to being the voice of the Lee Child books that actually you can do it fairly much sight unseen nowadays?
I would never, ever risk going into the studio unprepared. I am one of those guys who reads it once slowly and marks it up, and then I'm ready to go. But I wouldn't go in naked. That would be too scary. There's always some character on page 300 that you find out, oh, he's Australian. Oops.
Do you use a different intonation to your voice for Lee Child books and Clive Cussler books? Do you hear the voice of the author?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think every book I pick up dictates its own style and rhythm and form. So my voice will change for each one.
Do you ever ask to talk to the author beforehand to gauge their writing voice a bit more?
Generally, they've heard my voice on a clip, so that rarely happens. I did for Matterhorn, Carl Marlantis's book. He wanted to talk to me to make sure that the characters didn't all sound alike, and I was able to reassure him that they wouldn't.
Now, of course, you're not just a thriller reader. I notice there's an enormous number of autobiographies in there as well.
Yeah, those were really fun to read. One of the old movie Cowboys. I did Gary Cooper, and I think that was about second day in that. And I forget who I was recording with, but she turned to me and she said, "This guy sounds really interesting. Who is he?" Surprised me that we were bringing past generation forward.
Well, I noticed there was Meatloaf in there as well, To Hell and Back. That must have been quite a read.
There was a scene in that that I remember vividly, and it was when he left home, and he was taking a nap after high school, and his father came in, drunk and on drugs or whatever, and had a knife poised and descending rapidly toward his chest. And he said, "I rolled off the bed, I rolled out the door, and I never saw him again."
Thus was born Bat Out of Hell.
Oh, yeah.
You've done a couple of very, very weighty political autobiographies. I noticed 50 Hours of Bill Clinton's My Life. How was that?
Yeah, there's a story attached to that. I came in for so many sessions to do that. When I came in for the last one, 913 pages it was, Rupert and the gang played Hail to the Chief as I came down the stairs to the studios.
How did it compare to Barack Obama's autobiography?
Well, again, you know, I think every book has a personality. And, of course, you know, different writers help these guys with their books. So, yeah, just totally different.
Do you reckon you might be doing Donald Trump's autobiography in a few years?
Oh, God, there are some things I might have to say no to. No, I haven't got any sympathy for that guy. Both of my sisters voted for him, and they live there, so more power to them.
Well, I noticed you'd read Michael Moore's Stupid White Men as well, so maybe you've done the groundwork already.
Yeah, you know what side of the fence I'm on.
And you've done a fair amount of children's literature as well. I notice you're the voice of the Lemony Snicket novels.
Yeah, and what a treat those are. I love those things.
They're very fun, aren't they? My kids absolutely adored them.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad they listened to them.
And How the Grinch Stole Christmas by Dr. Seuss as well. Again, is it a different Jeff Harding that we get narrating children's books? Do you put yourself in a totally different frame of mind to the political biographies?
Yeah, well, of course, but, you know, I tend to give a fair amount of oomph to all my performances and books. Dr. Seuss is an excuse to go right over the top, and I really enjoy doing that.
Did you bring back some of the spirit that you were channeling in The Fast Show when you were Ed Winchester?
Treading the delicate balance of being a real TV presenter and a comedian, yeah. No, that was fun, too. But what I love about books is that I can work 8 hours nonstop and play lots and lots of different characters in a day, as opposed to hanging around on a film set and saying three lines.
Sure, and there's quite a camaraderie at the Talking Book Studios. I hear you all in the green room sharing biscuits and stories.
It is wonderful when we can get together with each other. There was one other company, now sadly gone, sit around during lunch and trade war stories and moan about our books, even if we like them. But no, it's great fun.
Do you enjoy doing the books where there are multiple narrators? I'm thinking like the Jodi Picoult books, where you might be narrating half of the book with Regina Regan or Laurence Bouvard doing the female part.
Yeah, I mean, I would relish the opportunity, and don't come across it often enough where we do a sort of radio play and we're all in the studio together. But otherwise, you know, I record a bit and then Laurence records a bit, or Regina, and we never see each other, but we do communicate so that we don't screw each other's accents up.
You've been doing this for many years now and have seen it grow from a rather niche activity for blind and partially sighted readers to being a major part of publishing output. Do you just see yourself getting more and more work being a narrator?
Well, that's the trend at the moment. I mean, everybody I know has listened to at least one. It's so easy now, you can download it onto your phone and listen to it on the way into work. I think a lot of people prefer it.
And if there was one book that you could be presented with off the library shelves and told to narrate, what would that be?
Well, my favorite one that I've done is Cheetah the Chimp's biography. It's called Me, Cheetah. He was assisted by James Lever in that effort. There's not enough comedy out there. I particularly like black comedy, so Carl Hyacin, anything by him.
Well, let's hope that the opportunity presents itself. Meanwhile, I know that you'll be back in the R&IB Talking Book Studios in the not-too-distant future. Have you got the next book lined up already?
Well, yeah, I'm coming in to read The Hunger.
Is that James Herbert?
No. It's Tony Scott made a movie of it years ago. I went up for it as an actor, didn't get the part, so now I'm getting another chance. it's a female vampire, and she's hungry.
Ah, well, I shall very much look forward to hopefully meeting you by the coffee machine rather than the blood bank.
Okay, it's a deal. I'll see you there.
Jeff Harding, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thanks, Rick.
And since that interview was recorded, Jeff has finished narrating The Hunger by Whitley Strieber and a few more besides. For a full list of the many books that Jeff Harding has narrated, go to the rniblibrary.com website or call the helpline on 0303 123
9999.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Now, before we share the books of Val Wood's life, let's return to Wigtown, where Robert Kirkwood learnt more about a fascinating new book that's just entered the RNIB Talking Books Library.
We all love animals, but does that make their lives happier? With factory farms, climate change and deforestation, this might be the worst time in history to be an animal. In his book and audiobook, How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World, Henry Mance sets out on a personal quest to see if there's a fairer way to live alongside other species. The audio version is read by the author.
Why is it okay to keep pigs in barren enclosures, but not dogs? Why is it morally wrong to hunt a dozen whales, but not to use fishing nets that entangle hundreds of dolphins? Put simply, love for animals is one of Western society's core values, and rational thinking is another. But the way we treat animals doesn't fit with either of these values. It is guided by tradition and inertia. No one would vote for the looming mass extinction of wild animals, certainly not the animals themselves. Goodness knows how we will explain it to the next generation. But it is happening on our watch. Charles Darwin concluded that blushing was the most human of all expressions, which is lucky, as we have plenty to blush about.
A clip of How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World by Henry Mance and read by the author, who I met at the Wigtown Book Festival.
The book is trying to find an ethos by which we can live more happily with animals. At the moment, I think lots of people feel uncomfortable about where their meat comes from, and they know that the standards on some farms are not great. And also people are worried about whether wild animals are going to be there. You know, a million animals are threatened, a million species are threatened with extinction. And so it's trying to think of a way that I and my kids might be able to live in a more harmonious way with other species.
And you're grappling with some big questions around things like hunting.
Yeah, hunting, you don't really get much more controversial than that, because people see it as the way it was in maybe the 18th, 19th century, as a kind of complete domination of other species. And of course, we've moved beyond that, and we now see that other animals have emotions, they have social lives, so how could we be so callous as to go out and shoot them? And one of the kind of the counterintuitive conclusions I come to in the book, as someone who doesn't eat meat or dairy, is that, and I'm not really okay with a lot of livestock farming, is that hunting can be better than that. It can be ethical, it can be a way of preserving wild spaces, of giving those wild spaces a value, and also of playing the roles of predators that we've extinguished. Across Britain, just before the shooting season begins, about half of birds are pheasants and partridges. I mean, you're talking tens of millions, I mean, the exact figure isn't known, released to be shot. And I think that is not ethical hunting. That is a sort of pastime that doesn't really play into the natural world. And also, the welfare implications of breeding those birds in cages is not something that I would support. And so it's the ethical hunting, it's the hunting which looks to work with the grain of the land, that says we are living within ecosystems and relationships that I'm sort of interested in.
Before coronavirus hit, optimists would often say that this was the best time ever to be a human, that if you could choose any time in history to be alive, it should be now. But what would other animals choose? If you were born as a non-human mammal today, there is a greater chance than ever before that you will be born in a factory farm, in cramped, unnatural conditions. In a large dairy farm, a cow produces perhaps 4 times as much milk as she would have done a century ago, but her life expectancy has actually fallen. As a wild animal today, you would likely have a greater risk than your preceding generations that your habitat is being destroyed, or that the climate is changing to something you can't adapt to. Wild animal populations have fallen 2/3 on average since 1970, according to the Living Planet Index. Because of the growth of animal trading, particularly in Asia, there's probably also as great a chance as ever that you would be taken from the wild and kept in cruel conditions. We might fancy the life of a dog in modern-day America, lazing on the sofa with organic biscuits and a whimsical Instagram account. But if we were randomly reincarnated, we'd be at least 20 times more likely to end up as American factory chickens. Given the choice of any time, would an animal choose to be born now? I don't think so.
Now, to the physics of the book, you read the audiobook yourself. How was that?
Oh my goodness. I mean, people don't realise how difficult it is. Certainly I didn't. And I spent hours with very kind, patient producers. And if you deviate one word, if you say which instead of that, there's someone listening in saying, uh-uh. So it was a real experience. But it gave me a chance really to reflect on the book, which I put together over months. And, you know, I realised how many people listen to books. And if that's bringing it to a wide audience, I always wanted to make sure this book, both in its tone, like it's not a miserable book, it has jokes, it's about my family, it has sort of hopefully nice anecdotes and statistics. So I really wanted to make sure that it was attractive to lots of people. And if being an audiobook is part of that too, and it is, then I'm so happy that it's out there in that way.
What would happen if we thought about animals, all animals? Would we change the way we source our food, the way we treat the natural world, and the way we look at animals in zoos? Like many people, I fell in love with animals because I thought they were beautiful. My family had a pet dog, and my parents took me to zoos. We'd watch the Grand National on TV, and I'd feel baffled that jockeyless horses were disqualified. Wasn't it kind of interesting that they ran faster once the humans had fallen off? At university, I was briefly vegetarian for environmental reasons, until I clicked the wrong option on a drop-down menu and ended up on a long-haul flight, being served a meal of raw carrots. In my 20s, I took up photography. I became obsessed with capturing the speed of hummingbirds, the detail on grasshoppers, and other kinds of animal wonder. In the spirit of George Best, I spent 90% of my money on camera lenses. The rest, I just wasted. Animals make the best photographs. Half a dozen silverfish shimmering on the dock. A Bornean orangutan dangling nonchalantly between trees. A young hippo on a Colombian farm once owned by drugs lord Pablo Escobar, who, unlike me, did regard raw carrots as soul food. The closer you look at our fellow creatures, the more astonishing they become. On the boat back from one photography outing, watching puffins battling the North Sea wind to return to their nests, I overheard a small boy murmur earnestly to his parents, "I love the puffins." "I love the puffins too," I thought. But what had I actually done for them, besides taking photos? Had my admiration made them any better off? Had I repaid the pleasure that they had given me? I was an animal lover in theory, but perhaps not in practice.
What message do you want people to take away from the book?
That when you say you love animals, that's not enough to be an animal lover. That actually being an animal lover involves thinking about your behaviour, thinking about your footprint on the natural world. And unfortunately, for too many years, we haven't been thinking about the impact on farm animals. We haven't been thinking about how much of the Earth's surface we're taking up and what we're throwing into the environment. And yet there are very simple things you can do, like eating less meat, eating less dairy, not flying as much, reducing your carbon footprint, and also just calling for change, calling for national parks to be created, donating to organisations who do that. And those changes can make a huge difference in what wildlife is available to our children, and it can, I think, lead us to live happier lives because animals give us so much pleasure.
How to Love Animals in a Human-Shaped World, written and read by Henry Mance, is available commercially now and in the RNIB Talking Books Library. For more information, call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 or head to rniblibrary.com.
Now it's back to Val Wood for the books of her life. Val, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, absolutely there was. And that book, which it will resonate with a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, was Little Women, Louisa M. Alcott. I was only young when I first read that, and I didn't realise that it was literature, and nor did I realise that many years on, it would inspire me to become an author. And last year, of course, I wrote Four Sisters. Now, this wasn't at all a copy of Little Women, because no one could possibly do that. But it did inspire me to write about a family of four sisters. And I absolutely loved it. It took me back to the time when I used to read such a lot.
"Joe? Joe, where are you?" cried Meg at the foot of the garret stairs. "Here," answered a husky voice from above. And running up, Meg found her sister eating apples and crying over the Heir of Redcliffe, wrapped up in a comforter on an old three-legged sofa by the sunny window. This was Jo's favourite refuge, and here she loved to retire with half a dozen russets and a nice book to enjoy the quiet and the society of a pet rat who lived nearby and didn't mind her a particle. As Meg appeared, Scrabble whisked into his hole. Jo shook the tears off her cheeks and waited to hear the news. "Such fun! Only see! A regular note of invitation from Mrs. Gardner for tomorrow night!" cried Meg, waving the precious paper and then proceeding to read it with girlish delight. "Mrs. Gardner would be happy to see Miss March and Miss Josephine at a little dance on New Year's Eve. Marmy is willing we should go. Now, what shall we wear?" "What's the use of asking that, when you know we shall wear our poplins because we haven't got anything else?" answered Jo, with her mouth full.
"If I only had a silk," sighed Meg. "Mother says I may when I'm 18, perhaps, but 2 years is an everlasting time to wait."
"I'm sure our pops look like silk, and they are nice enough for us. Yours is as good as new, but I forgot the burn and the tear in mine. Whatever shall I do? The burn shows badly, and I can't take any out."
"You must sit still all you can and keep your back out of sight. The front is all right. I shall have a new ribbon for my hair, and Marmy will lend me her little pearl pin, and my new slippers are lovely, and my gloves will do, though they aren't as nice as I'd like."
Gretel Davis narrating Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes. Oh, well, so many books. But with this one, this particular book, in actual fact, I'm cheating here, it is a series of books. Tales of the Utori by Leanne Hearn. Wonderful, wonderful, magical book. It could have been set in medieval Japan, and there are thrilling stories of magic, of battles, of bravery and love. And the first one is called Across the Nightingale Floor. And I can't stress enough, I can guarantee, however, that when you've read this first one, then you'll be sure to read the other two. Wonderful, wonderful stories.
The cicadas shrilled as loudly as ever. Frogs were calling from the paddies. In the distance, thunder echoed round the mountains. The air was heavy and humid. I was sweating, but the sweat was turning cold on my forehead. I jumped across the ditch of the last terraced field and looked down to where my home had always been. The house was gone. I went closer. Flames still crept and licked at the blackened beams. There was no sign of my mother or my sisters. I tried to call out, but my tongue had suddenly become too big for my mouth, and the smoke was choking me and making my eyes stream. The whole village was on fire, but where was everyone? Then the screaming began. It came from the direction of the shrine, around which most of the houses clustered. It was like the sound of a dog howling in pain, except the dog could speak human words, scream them in agony. I thought I recognized the prayers of the hidden, and all the hair stood up on my neck and arms. Slipping like a ghost between the burning houses, I went towards the sound. The village was deserted. I could not imagine where everyone had gone. I told myself they had run away. My mother had taken my sisters to the safety of the forest. I would go and find them just as soon as I had found out who was screaming. But as I stepped out of the alley into the main street, I saw two men lying on the ground. A soft evening rain was beginning to fall, and they looked surprised, as though they had no idea why they were lying there in the rain. They would never get up again, and it did not matter that their clothes were getting wet. One of them was my stepfather. At that moment, the world changed for me. A kind of fog rose before my eyes, and when it cleared, nothing seemed real. I felt I had crossed over to the other world, the one that lies alongside our own, that we visit in dreams.
Kevin Gray narrating Tales of the Utori by Leanne Hearn, which is available commercially.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, I can always go back to Pride and Prejudice. Perfect dialogue, sharp and humorous, and of its time. I've seen the film, book is better, as it always is. Jane Austen, of course, that's another one of my favourites.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. However little known the feelings or views of such a man may be on his first entering a neighbourhood, this truth is so well fixed in the minds of the surrounding families that he is considered as the rightful property of some one or other of their daughters. "My dear Mr. Bennet," said his lady to him one day, "have you heard that Netherfield Park is let at last?" Mr. Bennet replied that he had not. "But it is," returned she, "for Mrs. Long has just been here, and she told me all about it." Mr. Bennet made no answer. "Do not you want to know who has taken it?" cried his wife impatiently. "You want to tell me, and I have no objection to hearing it." This was invitation enough. "Why, my dear, you must know. Mrs. Long says that Netherfield is taken by a young man of large fortune from the north of England, that he came down on Monday in a chaise and four to see the place, and was so much delighted with it that he agreed with Mr. Morris immediately, that he is to take possession before Michaelmas, and some of his servants are to be in the house by the end of next week." "What is his name?" "Bingley." "Is he married or single?" "Oh, single, my dear, to be sure. A single man of large fortune, 4,000 or 5,000 a year. What a fine thing for our girls."
"How so? How can it affect them?"
"My dear Mr. Bennet," replied his wife, "how can you be so tiresome? You must know that I am thinking of his marrying one of them."
"Is that his design in settling here?"
Emilia Fox narrating Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Well, Thelwood, thank you so much for sharing your joy of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so very much. Thank you again for inviting me. I've had a lovely morning.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at talking_books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.